Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to Home in Progress, sponsored by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. And as you can certainly tell from the opening music, this is our much-anticipated annual Christmas extravaganza. And I'm sorry if you don't like these. I do. And that's what matters to me this giving time of the year. I'm going to give myself a little gift. You know, I mean, really, it's almost Christmas. I don't feel like home improvement stuff or talking about color theory or paint projects at this point in the year. And I don't know that you want to listen to it. So every single year, we kick back. We take one episode where we have a little bit of fun. We work our way through a bunch of unusual Christmas-related topics. And this year, I'm actually going to be giving away some presents. I'm going to be giving away 10 $100 gift certificates after the show concludes. 10 of them. So to get entered, all you need to do, I'm going to tell you right now, normally I save this for the end. I'm telling you right now, and I'll remind you throughout the show. To get entered, all you need to do is email me at radio@repcolite.com and tell me your favorite Christmas song, your favorite Christmas memory, whatever it is. You know, maybe your favorite gift, you know, the favorite gift you've ever given, your favorite gift you've ever received, what the season means to you, whatever. Have fun with it. Send me anything. Just email it to radio@repcolite.com, and then at the end of the show, after it concludes, I'll draw 10 random winners, and I'll email you right away and let you know if you won. All right, I'll remind you as we go multiple times, so you're aware of all of your opportunities to get entered. Okay, with that out of the way, that's business out of the way, let's kick things off with Christmas cards. You know, a lot of us send Christmas cards. A lot of us make a big deal out of creating the perfect, absolutely perfect Christmas card every single year. You know, the other day I was flipping through, you know, big box of old photos, and I stumbled into one of my favorite Christmas cards that we've ever sent out. Now, at the time, we had three kids, you know, five in total, but at that point we had three. Caleb and Maddie, they were the oldest, they were about five, and their brother Andrew was right around two, you know, the terrible, terrible twos. Anyway, we had big ideas for the picture, and we dressed them all up in spectacular, you know, little outfits, brushed their hair, cleaned the crunchy, you know, food off their faces, and we started taking solo photos of each kid. Maddie, she was beautiful. Caleb, he was dapper, you know, a dapper little gentleman. He looked great. They did wonderfully. And then we get to Andrew, and no matter what in the world we did, we couldn't get the kid to stop screaming. You know, he's just red-faced, rage screaming. He's leaning forward. His eyebrows are angled angrily. He's full-throated screaming. You know, we couldn't get a happy picture to save our lives. And we were getting frustrated, right? Anyway, the idea with this particular card was going to be separate photos of each kid mounted on this nice Christmas background, right? Everybody smiling, everybody happy, and then we'd put a nice little happy message with it. Well, when we couldn't get Devil Boy to stop screaming and hollering, inspiration struck me. You know, I snapped a picture of the angry screaming kid, and then I slapped that one on a card with the other two happy kids. We put a message on it that said, "May the joy that we experience every day in our home be with you this Christmas season." And then we mass-produced that card and sent them out to all our friends and family. All the fancy, perfect Christmas cards that we've ever made, I can't even remember them. But this one was absolutely sheer gold because of the screaming kid. Anyway, Christmas cards. That's really the whole point of that, Christmas cards. Nowadays, there's something that everybody sends out and have been doing. We've been doing that as people, as a collective group of people for ages. And if you don't send them out, you know, people do notice, right? You know, I don't mean to pile on more pressure, you know, during a season where there's already too much pressure, but people do log these things. You know, we used to have a spreadsheet that I kept up to find out who was sending us cards and who wasn't. Now, I'm not saying that didn't solely determine how we treated those people, you know, as the year unfolded, but I'm not really saying that it didn't figure in to how we treated them. Anyway, Christmas cards, they're kind of a big deal, but did you know that they weren't always viewed that way? In fact, when they were first introduced, people were, like, furious about them. Here's the scoop. Because people, you know, before I say why they were mad, I just think it's funny that people get mad about everything. You know, we sometimes think, I don't know about you, I can't say you, I sometimes think that, you know, the world has just gotten angrier, right? You know, people are more upset than they used to be. Used to be calm and cool and collected way back, you know, way back when. But nowadays, everybody's amped up. Everybody's looking for a fight. No, they were mad about Christmas cards. Not mad because they didn't get them. They were mad because they did, right? That's how mad people were back then. I could have sent Andrew's angry, screaming Christmas card back then, and they would have thought, yeah, this is how we feel getting this stupid Christmas card. Anyway, here's why they were mad. The first commercially produced Christmas card, it appears in 1843 in England. It was designed by artist John Calcutt Horsley and commissioned by a guy. I got hung up. I'm sorry, I paused. When I said Horsley, my brain played pictures of Mr. Ed, you know, the talking horse, and I was going to make a joke about that, but I figured that's not professional. But I couldn't get my train of thought back, so I paused, and now I've just really wrecked everything. I'm going to start over. It was designed, the very first Christmas card was designed by artist John Calcutt Horsley, not anything connected with Mr. Ed, and it was commissioned by a guy named Sir Henry Cole. And here's an important detail about Sir Henry Cole. That guy was busy. All right. He was busy. He was well connected, socially active. You know, he was completely overwhelmed by holiday correspondence because in Victorian England, if somebody sent you a Christmas letter, you were expected, you were socially obligated to write back, you know, by hand, with ink from an inkwell and in fancy, you know, looping penmanship. And on top of all of that, you had to be sincere. You had to be witty. You had to be heartfelt. You had to be loving. And thankfully, Sir Henry Cole basically said, nope, I don't have time for this kind of thing. And you know what? I don't think other people do either. So with that in mind, with those thoughts swirling in his little brain, he goes out and commissions a printed card with a simple message wishing people a Merry Christmas. And then he had 1,000 cards printed up. He sent some of them off himself, and then the rest he sold to the public. And once people saw them, especially people who were just as busy, or just as socially entangled as he was, when they saw him, the idea really started to spread fast. You know, suddenly this wasn't just one guy dodging his mail, you know, and his social responsibilities. It was a new way of handling Christmas altogether. However, while some people liked it, I told you already, some people were mad, others hated it. Almost immediately, Christmas cards were criticized as impersonal. You know, that's what they're mad about. These are impersonal. Victorian commentators complained that sending a printed card was a shortcut, a way of avoiding real effort. Yeah, that's the whole point, right? I mean, I can't imagine that you're mad about that, but I guess these people were extremely tender souls, and they wanted long, heartfelt messages. You know, if I knew that they were feeling that way about Christmas cards I was sending, I would send them some real heartfelt messages, but I don't know that they'd want to read them, and it certainly wouldn't be in the Christmas spirit. Anyway, they're frustrated about that because they're seeing it as a way of people, you know, avoiding any real effort. The general idea was if you really cared, you'd write. You know, you wouldn't just send a card, you'd write. But Christmas cards spread anyway, and they spread fast, and they did that because they solved a real problem. People had more social connections than ever before. I wonder what that's like. My social connections are pretty limited, and even at that point, there's too many of them. But back then, people were, you know, moving and shaking. They were rubbing elbows with people, and they just couldn't keep up with everything. They had fewer hours to maintain all these new relationships. They had things to do, people to see, and writing pages and pages and pages of heartfelt, you know, heartfelt letters to everybody on their list, it was just out of the question. Couldn't do it. So Christmas cards let people stay connected across distance and time. They made it possible to acknowledge relationships that would otherwise fade. And slowly, because of that, the criticism softened. And what had once been dismissed as a lazy thing started to look practical, right? People started to realize this is a good way to go. It started to look thoughtful because not sending anything, that was way worse than just sending a card. And then over time, the whole Christmas card thing flipped entirely on its head. It went from being a social shortcut to being a social obligation. From something suspicious, you know, they must not care enough, something that was, you know, kind of making me mad, to something I'm expecting. I'm going to the mailbox every day. Where's my card from so-and-so? Haven't seen it yet. I'm going to put them on my spreadsheet. They're going to be sorry if they don't get me a card, right? That's how it changed. And today, if somebody sends you a Christmas card, you're certainly not thinking, wow, that's impersonal. You know, what a jerk this person is. You think, that was nice of them. Or if you're like me, you think, oh, no, I didn't send them anything. Now what? Maybe I'll text them. You know, does that count? Can I text? And that's where we're at right now. And the same debate is raging. Are texts less personal than phone calls? Yeah, but they're quicker. Right? That's a plus. Are emails worse than letters? We ask all these questions. Every single new form of communication starts out as kind of suspicious, or kind of suspicious is the wrong word. Impersonal, that's probably a better way to think about it. We worry that it's hollow, that it's lazy, that it's replacing something that was more meaningful. And then slowly, thank goodness, these things become normal. You know, Christmas cards didn't ruin Christmas. They didn't destroy sincerity. They just adapted it to a world that was getting bigger and busier. They weren't perfect, but they were human. And in the end, that's why they stuck, you know, in one form or another. And that's why someday we'll all be sending Christmas texts, and that will be good enough. And eventually, those texts will be reduced from actual words to just an emoji. And we won't feel, you know, that we got the short end of the stick when we get a smiling emoji for Christmas. We'll feel like, wow, that's exactly what I was hoping for. All right, that's enough of that. Many of us can't wait for Christmas songs to start playing on the radio every single year. And others of us, you know, we want to hold off Mariah Carey as long as is humanly possible. Either way, wherever we land in that debate, few of us probably think about the days before radio, you know, the silent days of Christmas. So let's go back to the day that Christmas hit the airwaves for the very first time. And we're going to do that right after this. Home in Progress is brought to you by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. You know, people often think of paint as just another line item on the project supply list. But here's the thing. Everything you do, every hour of prep, every stroke of the brush, all comes down to the quality of the paint. The paint is the project. Make sure it's the best. Well, we're just kicking off our Christmas extravaganza 2025. And as I mentioned in the last segment, at the end of the show, I'm going to give away 10 $100 Repco Light gift certificates. And to get entered into that contest so you can win one, just send me an email right now or anytime throughout the show. You email radio@repcolite.com and you tell me your favorite Christmas memory, your favorite Christmas song, favorite tradition, favorite story, whatever. As long as it's Christmas related. Send those emails to radio@repcolite.com. And then after the show concludes, I'll draw 10 random winners and I'll email you right away to let you know. And I may email respond to everybody. So just because you get an email from me, don't freak out and think you won. You got to read the message to find out. Either way, you won because I'm reaching out to you. But you may not have won the prize. That's normally why I don't respond to everybody who emails the show for a contest. I'm always afraid somebody's going to think they won something when they didn't. All right, Christmas music. It's ubiquitous, right? It's everywhere you look, everywhere you listen, everywhere you listen. The grocery store, the coffee shop, the car, you're driving around. Even if you try to avoid Christmas music, somehow Mariah Carey, she's going to find you, right? She's going to find you and make you listen to everything she's saying. But here's something worth sitting around and thinking with for just a minute. For most of human history, Christmas was actually pretty quiet, right? No background music, no shared soundtracks, no Bing Crosby, no Mariah, nothing, really, except the sounds of song and voice that you could generate on your own, you know, in your own family. And that all changed for everybody on Christmas Eve 1906 with a guy who really, really wanted people to understand how smart he was and what he had figured out. All right. His name was Reginald Aubrey Fessenden. He was Canadian born, working in the United States. He was briefly employed by Thomas Edison. And by most accounts, Fessenden was brilliant and difficult. The best of us are, right? The smarter you get, the harder you are to tolerate. He was convinced he was right about pretty much everything, you know, everything. And that's really annoying for all his friends and acquaintances. You know, no matter what subject came up, good old Reg, he just knew better, right? He had something to say about everything, I'm sure. You know, and we all have a Reg in our lives. Sometimes we're the Reg in our lives, right? In other people's lives anyway. And to be honest, in the grand scheme of things, it's more fun to be Reg than it is to endure Reg. So if you've got to choose, you know, you'll have fewer true friends, but you'll have more fun at parties if you're the Reg. Anyway, good old Reg Fessenden, he thought he was pretty much the smartest guy in every room that he walked into. And what probably made him harder to tolerate than just that is that he was usually right about it. You know, the guy was brilliant. One of the areas where he really demonstrated his smarts was in terms of radio. Now, we don't even think about radio anymore. You know, we're just so used to radio and streaming and Wi-Fi and Bluetooth and all of these different technologies that we rarely think how crazy the concept really is, or at least how crazy it seemed, you know, a long time ago. I mean, way back when, radio, what they called wireless, was considered a near miracle, yet it was basically just a fancy telegraph. You know, I don't know that everybody realizes that, but when you hear people talking about the wireless or wireless, originally what they're talking about is something that really could only send and receive, you know, signals in one way. You know, on and off is the concept. It can be beeps, clicks, you know, Morse code, but that's it. And that meant one thing very clearly. You can't send sound over the wireless. Not sound like the human voice. You know, the human voice isn't an on-off kind of a thing. Music isn't on and off. They're continuous waves. You know, their shape, tone, vibration, all of that. It's not an on-off thing. So that's radio back then. That's how it worked in Reginald's day. Just beeps and, you know, basically Morse code. But he was adamant that it didn't need to be limited to just that. And even though most people assumed that voice transmission over radio just wasn't possible, good old Reg, you know, the smartest guy in the room, the guy who knows better, he believed it was and he persevered. And eventually, because he really was as smart as he thought he was, he eventually figured out the answer. And he discovered that instead of interrupting the signal, you know, triggering the on and off, the dots and dashes kind of effect, instead of doing that, you could ride sound on top of the signal. All right, you take a steady radio wave. I'm not going to get all sciencey here. I'm going to do my best to not to dumb it down because you're an incredibly brilliant audience. I'm going to make it as simple as possible. You take a steady radio wave, something continuous and unbroken, and then you modulate it. You shape it. You let the vibrations of a human voice change the strength of that wave as it travels. So the signal stays on the whole time, and the information is carried in how it moves. So think about it like ocean waves. You know, the tide is steady. That's the radio signal. Your voice is kind of like the wind on top of it, shaping the size of the waves. That's amplitude modulation, or shortened, it's AM radio. And that insight changed everything. All right, so that's what he came up with. That's his idea. But how did he bring, you know, sound and voice and music to Christmas? Well, that part of the story happens with a first ever Christmas Eve broadcast that Reg airs. Now, what we actually know about what happened the night that he aired this broadcast is a little bit sketchy. You know, we know enough to be confident that it really did happen, but we don't know enough to really build a beautiful made-for-TV movie out of it. We do know that it happened on Christmas Eve, 1906. We know that it came from Brant Rock, Massachusetts. That's where he broadcast from. We know that it used a continuous wave transmitter, something that was radically different from the on-off spark transmitters that everybody else was using. And we know that it carried music and spoken words in a way radio simply hadn't done before. That part isn't in dispute. What's less clear is pretty much everything else, which is really too bad because it would make for an amazing, fun story. But we don't have all those details. We do have some info, though, that helps us flesh it out a little bit. We know that this wasn't spontaneous. You know, that Reg wasn't just sitting around one day and, you know, flipped on the microphone and just started talking. You know, he'd been working towards this voice transmission for years, and this particular event was a very deliberate demonstration of the technology and what he could do. But it also wasn't a broadcast in the modern sense. You know, there was no studio, no established audience, no expectation that this was going to make headlines the next morning. You know, radio didn't have listeners yet. It had operators, but not really listeners. You know, nobody was listening for entertainment. It was work. So basically, if anybody knew to listen for this broadcast, it would really have only been a very small group. Wireless telegraph operators on ships and possibly a few coastal stations. Now, at most, they may have been told something like, hey, keep your equipment on tonight. You might hear something kind of unusual. You know, that's about it for the prep and the marketing of the event. But think about it for just a minute. because it's so intriguing to me. You know, I love firsts, you know. Well, yes, I love hearing about firsts. I don't necessarily want to be involved, you know, in a first of anything, unless it's something really amazing. But like the first surgery to have such and such removed from your body. Not big on being the first for that, but the story is interesting. Just thinking that somebody thought, I can pull all of these intestines out and set them aside and do some work over here and put everything back in place. You know, let's try that. You know, that first one, that's really intriguing. Just not to be the person, but to hear about it. So I love thinking about this first broadcast. You know, imagine being a ship's radio operator in 1906, okay? You're trained to listen for beeps, clicks, patterns. That's it. That's your entire world. That's all you've ever heard through the headphones that you're sitting there, you know, monitoring. Then you get this night, Christmas Eve, 1906. You're sitting around. You're monitoring your equipment. You're minding your own business. You're thinking about parties or whatever. I wish I was home. I wish I was unwrapping presents. I wish I wasn't here. You know, whatever. And then all of a sudden, something comes through the static that's completely unexpected. It's not beeps or anything like that. It's actually a human voice. And then you hear music, you know, a violin playing something like "O Holy Night." It had to be absolutely an incredible moment, you know, stunning. Yet the only info, frustratingly, the only info we have is that a number of wireless operators talked later about how it was impossible. You know, they couldn't understand how this was happening. They couldn't believe what they were hearing. Some thought their equipment was malfunctioning. Others reached out to nearby operators to see if they were hearing the same thing. There's some stories of people saying, you know, my goodness, this is a human voice. It was stunning to them, but like I said, sadly, we don't have more of that info, but it had to be absolutely mind-blowing. Now, the broadcast itself was really short. Again, I don't have that information. There is a reproduction of what people think it might have sounded like. I'll link to that in the show notes. It's really interesting, and it's well done. I mean, it's going to give you a vibe, and it's really got, you know, a cool feel to it, especially listen to that reproduction with the idea that all you've ever heard coming through speakers before or through the headphones over the wireless are beeps and clicks. Now imagine hearing this violin, you know, on Christmas Eve. It had to be really, really powerful. Now, of course, it takes time to develop and mature and to find its way into homes, right? In 1906, radios were expensive. They were complicated. They were rare. Wireless stays the thing for another decade and a half. But then World War I ends and there's surplus equipment. There's trained operators, technical knowledge spreads, and radios become more affordable and accessible. And then in 1920, KDKA, a station in Pittsburgh, broadcast the results of the Harding-Cox presidential election. And this time, regular people hear it in their living rooms, families all gathered around, and suddenly radio absolutely explodes. You know, by 1922, there are hundreds of stations. By the mid-20s, radio is everywhere. And in regards to Christmas, radio does something almost magical to the holiday. Again, think about it. It creates shared time and shared experiences. You know, before radio, Christmas was really, really local. Whatever happened in your house was the experience. And now all of a sudden, millions of people everywhere can hear the same thing, the same song, the same story, the same voice, all of it at the same time. That had never, ever happened before in the history of the world. This is an incredibly major event. And then, of course, once advertisers and sponsors get involved, radio doesn't just spread Christmas traditions, it ends up creating them. Rudolph exists because of radio. White Christmas becomes the best-selling single of all time because of radio. So when we talk about Christmas music being everywhere today, inescapable even, it's worth remembering this. 120 years ago, none of this existed. Christmas was quiet. And then somebody figured out how to send a human voice through the air without turning the signal on and off. And that one technical breakthrough didn't just change communication. It changed how we experience time and memory and togetherness. It took something that used to happen only in your house and made it happen everywhere at once. So, sometimes the music drives us a little crazy. I get that. But it also means that the silence doesn't get to dominate the scene the way it used to. And that has shaped how we experience Christmas. And honestly, it's shaped how we experience the modern world. All right. Most of us love Christmas lights, right? And some of us go to extravagant measures to light up our homes and our exteriors every season. But have you ever wondered about that, the whole process of getting there? You know, why do we reach for lights in the first place? Why did people a couple hundred years ago risk putting burning candles on their trees? You know, what's the big deal with Christmas lights anyway? We'll get into all of that right after this. You're listening to Home in Progress, where the projects are real, the mistakes, they're educational, sometimes painful, mostly educational, and the only thing more stubborn than that old wallpaper on your bathroom wall is your determination to get it fixed. Proudly sponsored by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. Paint with a purpose, people who care, and everything you need to get the job done right. Well, we're wrapping up our Christmas extravaganza 2025. And before I get to the last segment, as I mentioned in, you know, pretty much the rest of the show, all the earlier parts of the show, at the end of the show today, I'm going to be giving away 10 $100 RepcoLite gift certificates. If you want a chance to win one of those, all you need to do is send me an email right now. Email radio@repcolite.com. Tell me your favorite Christmas memory, your favorite Christmas song, maybe your favorite Christmas tradition or story or anything. Honestly, if you can't think of anything like that, just tell me a topic that you'd love me to cover in a future episode. Put all of that or any of that in an email and send it to radio@repcolite.com. And then I'll draw 10 random winners around 9:15 or so this morning. And then I'll alert you right away as to whether you won or not. All right, Christmas lights. They're pretty cool, right? Lots of folks invest huge amounts of time and energy into planning and decorating their homes with them every single year. And then another group of us, a large group of us, spend a lot of time driving around and judging how well these folks did. You know, my family loves this game. And I know you all do the same thing. We all judge everybody all the time. We walk past or drive past houses and we're scoping them out. You know, do they pass the test? Do they fail? Do we like that combination of lights over there? Do we like those colors or are those a little gaudy? Those might be a little gaudy. What do you guys think? What about the flashing lights over here? Are we up on those? Do we like them? Are they making us feel festive? Or are they kind of making us feel like we're going to have a seizure? You know, we do that all season long. We love it. Anyway, Christmas lights. They're so much a part of our modern Christmas celebrations that I really doubt many of us spend a lot of time thinking about the fact that for most of history, having Christmas lights actually meant toying around with potential life-altering fire damage and destruction. Right. If you were going to win any home decorating contest back then around the Christmas season, you had to be willing to run the risk of burning your house to the ground. Because remember, having lights on a tree until relatively recently meant literal candles and open flames on dry pine branches. So when I think about that, a ton of questions come to mind. You know, first, why did people decide to add lights to Christmas trees in the first place? You know, what made them think it was okay to do that, to bring those lights in with candles? You know, what did they do to keep it safe? And then how did we get from candles to electric lights? I mean, we all know it's the natural flow of progress, but there was a first time that people saw electric lights on the tree. What was that like and how did it move from there and end up in all of our homes? So let's look at all of that and let's start here. Why did people start adding lights to the tree and what made them think it was okay to do that with candles? Well, first off, the reason for adding lights goes way deeper than just thinking it looked pretty. There's a lot of symbolism and hope and belief wrapped up in the lights. You know, darkness back then was way different than darkness is now. You know, you can just hear the old timers if you listen. You know, back in my day, the darkness, it was really dark, not this wimpy darkness that you've got today. Right? Can't you hear the old people just saying that at all the family get-togethers? I can. But as silly as that concept kind of sounds, it was actually true. You know, back in the day, that darkness was dark. I mean, there's no streetlights. There's no glow, you know, from neighboring houses. There's no cars going by on a regular basis. Once the sun went down, the world went pretty dark. So light wasn't just decorative. It was psychological. You know, it pushed back against something people genuinely feared. And humans have been fighting winter darkness for ages. You know, long before Christianity was prevalent in Europe, people celebrated the winter solstice with fire and light. You know, the Yule log, bonfires, candles in windows, and so on. And then when Christianity spread through Europe, it didn't erase these traditions, it redeemed them. You know, the church took that ancient human need, light in the darkness, and it gave it new meaning. You know, Christmas falls right after the winter solstice, the darkest point of the year. And Christianity said this is when the light of the world enters the world. You know, Christ is that light. Hope is breaking into the darkness. The candles on the tree weren't just pushing back the night anymore. They were actually representing something eternal and something incredibly hopeful. And for people whose faith shaped pretty much every part of daily life, that symbolism wasn't abstract. It was essential. You know, they knew there was danger in putting candles on the tree, but the meaning or the symbolism justified the danger. And also, when it comes to understanding how or why they would accept that risk so readily, we should remember a couple of things that it kind of puts it in perspective. First off, the folks that lived in this world, they lived with fire all the time. You know, homes were heated by open flames. Food was cooked over fire. Candles and oil lamps were the only source of light after sunset. So fire wasn't an unusual danger like it kind of is to us now. It was pretty much a daily companion. So lighting a tree with candles didn't feel as completely foreign and nuts to them as it does to us. And to keep things as safe as possible, here's some things I wasn't aware of. I should have, you know, I guess if you just think it through for more than 2 minutes, you'll come to this conclusion. But I never thought it through for more than just a couple minutes. Anyway, the tree wasn't lit all night long, you know, with the candles. You know, it's not like what we do now. The tree was basically lit very briefly, you know, often for just a few minutes and usually only on Christmas Eve. You know, the family gather together, that one kid, you know, we've all got that one kid or maybe more of them in our home who knocks everything over and breaks everything. You know, that kid was probably locked away in another room somewhere. But the rest of the family would gather, they'd light the tree, they'd have a moment, probably say a prayer, sing a song, and then they'd put the candles out. And on top of that, most of them had water ready to go, you know, just in case. So those are the beginnings. And then we move into the 1800s and we start to get some safety improvements, but it's not like they're really knocking it out of the park here. So don't get too excited. For example, you get candle holders, little clip-on devices, little metal mounts that will hold the candle upright, but you're still clipping them, you know, burning candles onto pine branches. So it was all baby steps at that point. The big shift started in the late 1800s when electricity began to slowly make its way into homes. Then, in 1882, Edward H. Johnson, the vice president of the Edison Electric Light Company, Edward H. Johnson decorated a Christmas tree in New York with 80 electric light bulbs. And not only that, he did it with incredible flair. You know, the bulbs were red, white, and blue, and the tree actually rotated on a revolving pedestal. Now, the display that he set up drew a crowd, it drew the press, and everybody was excited because at the time, you know, electric lighting itself was still new and exciting, and nobody had really ever seen a Christmas tree put together. You know, there are newspaper articles we can still find today where they recount, you know, just this amazing thing that they were viewing, you know, seeing all these lights on a tree. They found it, you know, the people who were writing the articles found it to be one of the most beautiful things they'd ever seen in their lives. It was that exciting. But even with all that, even with the fact that it looked amazing, the costs and the fact that most homes didn't have electricity kind of made the whole idea of Christmas lights, electric ones, non-starters. Candles, even with all their problems, were still cheap. They were still familiar. And so for a while yet, they persisted. In fact, for about another 25 years, candles were still the primary way that most people lit their trees. Then, finally, by the early 1900s, as electricity becomes more common in the cities, you start seeing electric Christmas lights show up more often. The biggest step to get us to, you know, where we are today, that biggest step came in 1917 when a teenager named Albert Sadaka thought to repurpose the white novelty lights that his family produced in their business and switch them over to colored bulbs, creating the very first Christmas lights that were safe for widespread use in the homes. Now, he proposed that idea, worked on it, and it took off. And as these lights were mass-produced, the cost came down, and finally, average families could afford them. And from there, the transition away from candles accelerated quickly. You know, within a decade or two, the idea of lighting a Christmas tree with open flames wouldn't feel just old-fashioned, it'd feel absolutely nuts, you know, pretty much like we would think of it today. And as those lights became more and more popular and began to see more and more use, something really interesting begins to happen. You know, just like we talked about with radio and how that changed the vibe of Christmas. With the lights, the whole vibe of Christmas starts to change. Electric lights make the Christmas tree less of a brief, supervised moment and more of an all-night glow. You know, you can leave them on the entire Christmas season. You can enjoy them all of that time safely. You can sit in the living room and let the tree be a part of the atmosphere, not just an event that you risk your life and your home for. You don't need 12 buckets of water sitting in the living room just in case. Anyway, once the indoor lights became reliably safe, the next obvious step was to go outdoors. And that brings us to where we're at today. With all of the crazy, you know, chaotic and amazing Christmas light displays that we see all around our neighborhoods this time of year. All right, there you go. That's going to do it for this episode of Home in Progress. The next 2 weeks are going to be a couple of best of shows that I'll put together. And then starting January 10, we'll be back with new stuff. Now, I want to wish all of you from all of us at RepcoLite a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And don't forget to get your emails in if you want a chance to win one of 10 $100 RepcoLite gift certificates. Email me right now at radio@repcolite.com and tell me something about your favorite Christmas or your favorite song, your favorite Christmas song, or even tell me some topics that you'd love me to cover on new episodes as we start 2026. I'll be digging through all of the emails I've received from the beginning of the show until about 9:15 this morning. And then I'll pick 10 random winners. Remember, though, I'm going to respond to all of these emails. So just because you get an email back from me, don't assume you won, only to end up being disappointed. The message was going to tell you if you won or not. So when you see an email come, you still got to read it to find out if you won. Don't get all pumped up and think you're a winner and then be disappointed. I hate to bring disappointment. So get those emails into radio@repcolite.com. You've got a few minutes yet. All right, everybody have a great weekend and a blessed Christmas, and I'll see you next week. I'm Dan Hansen for Home in Progress. Thanks for listening.